So fog I saw was rolling in. Hopefully I won't make it worse with my presentation. So there's my title, and I think I'll just start off with a little video to sort of set up the problem. This is a monkey, and he's in front of a waterfall, which I hope you can hear. Did you just hear that bird? And you'll see he'll move around. And so basically what this guy does is he lives in an environment where there's this constant sound, and he's moving relative to that sound. And so the problem for him, well, it's a little different. Like the more, a problem probably you've all had experience with is checking into a hotel room and an air conditioner comes on and it kind of drives you crazy, and eventually hopefully you tune it out and you're able to fall asleep. And that's a form of adaptation, which probably happens at the level of the inferior colliculus and has to do with decreased responsiveness of the neurons, decreased firing rate of the neurons in the inferior colliculus over time to this constant stimulus, which would be the sound of the air conditioner. This is a bit of a more complicated problem because the animal is moving relative to the sound, or the sound might be moving relative to the animal. But now the animal knows that sound's there. It's not something that's going to eat him. It's not something he's going to eat. He doesn't want to have sex with it. And so he maybe wants to tune it out, have it in the background so that he's ready for novel sounds like the bird that chirped, something to eat or something that might eat him. And so I'm going to talk about the mechanism so that we think underlie that sound. And well, here, so first of all, I'm just going to do a brief introduction about adaptation and then tell a bit about the circuit that we work on. And so let's get to it. Okay, so adaptation, this is the classic work which basically first described adaptation back in the 1920s from Adrian. Basically what he did here was to take a muscle and dissect out one end of it and record from the afferents, from what probably was the Golgi tendon organ, but the part of the muscle that projects back to the nervous system, tells the nervous system what the muscle's doing. And he put a weight on the muscle and it stretched it. And so during this constant weight or the constant stretch of the muscle, what he observed was when he loaded it up that the firing rate in the afferents going back to the nervous system increased and then gradually decreased even though the stimulus was staying the same. And then they take the weight away and the thing stops firing. So this was the classic description of adaptation, and in this particular case it was in a sensory system or an afferent system. So spike adaptation is really a subset, or it's a dynamic of synaptic integration. It's a special case where, at least the way I define it, is a change in the output activity to a constant input. And as you'll see, it's not necessarily always a decrease in spike rate. It's context dependent. And I'm going to just do a brief example that's not the meat of the talk, but it's actually from neocortex, which sort of makes the point about it being context dependent. And what it's good for, well, to get insight may be good for a lot of different things, but if you look at it in its natural context, which is what we can do in the auditory system, that may give some insight into its function. Okay, so this is from a pyramidal neuron in cortex. This is something that many people have seen in many labs, and you stimulate with an intracellular recording one of these cells with a step of current, and you can see it fires action potentials, and the rate of the action potential firing gradually slows down. That's plotted here, where the frequency or the instantaneity is firing rates plotted versus time. You can see there's this initial decrease, and then there's this slow decrease in firing rate calls. Slow spike frequency adaptation, or some people call it spike frequency accommodation. But this is not, neurons in the central nervous system don't usually see steps of current. What they see is very noisy inputs. And so if you then superimpose some fluctuations all about that same mean, what you find then is that the spike output becomes more variable. But the other thing is, if you look at this slow adaptation, it actually is much less. And if you increase the variability of those noisy inputs, so here is a noise level of 2, 4, and 6 standard deviations of what the current was, what you can see is the amount of adaptation, the percent adaptation, gets less and less. So then you might say, well, during a natural stimulus, which would be these sort of more fluctuating inputs, you know, maybe this doesn't really even do that much. But now, if you look, so now I just want to look at the same cell over a whole range of inputs. So we're going to stimulate the cell again with a step of current, and here's fluctuations about the mean, bigger fluctuations, more fluctuations, and build up a whole family of these by doing bigger means and a whole range of input fluctuations. And then look at what happens to the mean firing rate at the beginning of each of these steps or at the end. And that's plotted here, where we're plotting the firing rate versus the mean current for all these different standard deviations of.
This is Gaussian noise.
This is Gaussian noise, in this case, passed through, I think it was a 5 millisecond exponential filter. So sort of to match
something more natural, and then, so the knee-jerk tendency is to think that you put like a noise with a 1/f spectrum with some kind of cutoff.
Yeah, so, well, this is actually passed through an exponential filter, which looks a lot like, say, the EPSPs in these cells. So it actually does have a fairly natural look to it. In fact, we've done this with 1/f noise, and we get very similar results. So, but it is, that's a whole other story that I don't want to get into. The amount, these effects are actually very dependent on the filter that you put the noise through.
Because we started with the data from Adrian, and you showed that when spiking became very regular, you lost your adaptation, right?
No, I don't think I showed.
That got went smaller, right? The initial data.
His spike rate, that's true, that got smaller, and he was loading up a muscle with weight. And so that wasn't a fluctuating input. He was just had a muscle and stretched it to a constant amount. This is different. This is a central neuron that you're stimulating with what would be a bunch of excitatory and inhibitory inputs. And to get a constant mean and change the standard deviation, what you would do is keep balanced inhibition and excitation and just increase both. Or you could increase the excitation and crank up the mean and then go through a whole nother range of fluctuations. Okay? No. We'll talk about it more later. Maybe I shouldn't have put this in because this is just a brief introduction. I want to get to another part of the brain, but okay. But the point here is that you do still have some adaptation that is going on, but you have to look at it a little differently. So if you look at these curves, firing rate versus mean current, and the slope of these are usually considered to be the gain of the neurons, you can see that at the beginning of each of these steps, the cell behaves very much like a perfect integrator in the sense that it doesn't care at all about fluctuations. It basically is just responding to the mean. But when you wait a little bit in time, like 2 or 3 seconds, now what you find is that the gain actually goes up as you increase the fluctuations. This is actually a little bit different than what sort of an old dogma was there from a paper by Chance, Abbott, and Reyes, which said when they put in fluctuations, they actually decreased the gain. There, we could get into that, but there's reasons why I think that came out the way it did and isn't totally right. And most neurons, at least in layer 2-3 of neocortex, actually show this behavior. So this is something that people are very interested in terms of attention mechanisms as a way to change gain during attention, and it's a way to crank the dial up or increase the gain. But I put this in primarily as an example to show that you sort of have to look at the context at which these things occur to really see what's going on.
I guess I'm just a little confused, because normally when people talk about attention, they talk about like acetylcholine going up, and then they talk about, you know, like the signal to noise of the cell increasing. Like there are these Meserith and Ash papers where you put acetylcholine on, I guess a lot of channels close, MCAR is not an activating sodium current. And see, so attention, I thought, would have given you the opposite effect. It would have killed fluctuations, not increased fluctuations.
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. I think there are examples where where you actually get increased noise in attention. But I don't know if anybody's actually ever measured that directly during an attention thing. I think people have sort of postulated that and looked for things that might increase the gain. I mean, you know, we could speculate what they are. I don't actually know of a specific example where somebody during an attention task has sort of actually seen what the fluctuations are doing. Does anybody?
There's some recent work from the Reynolds lab, I think. I don't want to try to recall what it was.
So the Reynolds lab, just to kind of quote it, recently showed that with attention, the reliability of the responsiveness got better. So the noisiness of the responses got less.
Less.
But that's not the same as what you're talking
right.
about. That you're talking about membrane variance.
Yeah.
They're talking about variability from trial to trial.
Yeah.
Right. Between neurons.
So right. So I'm talking about membrane variance. And something like acetylcholine, in fact, might change synaptic release. And there are some situations, I think, where it actually increases synaptic noise. But it does a bunch of things. So I mean, I wouldn't want to predict the overall effect of just something like acetylcholine in cortex. Okay. Anyway. It's fair game. I agree. Okay. Now I'm going to switch to the auditory system, and I want to talk about this at least the possible mechanisms and evidence for this type of adaptation. I showed the video of at the beginning, so I need to give a little bit of background. And basically, our thinking about how we localize sounds in space came from Lord Rayleigh, guy that got the Nobel Prize for discovering argon. But in his later years, he got into thinking about sound waves. And he basically wrote out a theory based on his knowledge of sound waves. And based on that theory, he said, well, there are two cues that we might be using for localizing sound along the horizontal. And one was that there would be a decrease in the intensity of sound as it went from one ear to the other. So sound in the front would be same intensity of both ears. And as you move further and further off to the side, the head would shadow it more, and the intensity would fall off more as it got more lateralized. But he also, you know, went through the calculations and found that for sounds below about in his case, he went down to about 1,000 hertz, that attenuation isn't really very big. And so he thought, that's probably not going to be a very good cue for that. But then he also realized, well, there's going to be a time difference in the time of arrival at the sound at the two ears, and that if we could decode that, or encode that and then decode it, that could be another cue, and that would be something that we would use for low frequency sounds rather than high frequency sounds. So he then, he actually said, geez, I can't imagine that there'd ever be a mechanism for that, but he took his wife and his butler and he stuck them in the gazebo, and he did some free field experiments, and he built some fancy apparatus and put it on their heads and made pure tones and gave them virtual sounds where he systematically manipulated the amplitude and the phase delay of pure tones coming to one ear to the other ear, and was able to conclude that yes, indeed, we use the difference in intensity between the two ears for high frequency and the difference in time arrival at the two ears for lower frequency sounds. And that started something called the duplex theory of sound localization, and people have been working ever since then figuring out the neural mechanisms of that. So this is where we work, and I'm going to just be concentrating. What I work on is this interaural time difference pathway. And we do this in slices of brain from the brainstem of chickens right around the time of hatching. And so this just shows a MAP2 stain of the two nuclei that I'm going to be telling you about today and some of their properties. And this is a little schematic of the circuit. So there's this one group of cells called the nucleus magnus ocellaris, and the mammalian equivalent would be the bushy cells in the anterior ventral cochlear nucleus. And they're very, very similar in their properties. And so here they are down there. These cells get inputs from the eighth nerve from the periphery, and they have very special synapses. I'll tell you a little bit more about them. And they get, on average, three inputs per cell. And then these guys just get inputs from one side, and then each of these cells then projects binaurally. They send an axon out that goes to the contralateral and the ipsilateral nucleus laminaris, which is shown here. And the nucleus laminaris is the bird's homolog of the medial superior olive in mammals, which also has similar properties. Just I want to point out that this, they're like an accordion. These are dendrites sticking out in either sides. And at least in the bird, there's this gradient, remarkable gradient of dendritic length. And there's a lot of sort of interest in why they would have this gradient of dendritic length. And I might have time to say a little bit about that. So this is the basic circuit we're going to be working on. Okay, so here's just a little cartoon or schematic to show how this system works, and I'll get into it in a little bit more detail. So here's the two ears, here's the eighth nerve inputs. I've got two coming on to an NM cell on the left and on the right. It takes usually one or two of these inputs going off simultaneously to get one of these NM cells to fire. Let's start this going. And then, and there's the sound waves sitting over there. And then these NM cells project, as I said, to these NL neurons through a system of delay lines. And the way this works is on every cycle of this, well, on some cycles of these sounds, these eighth nerve fibers fire. And they don't all fire on every cycle, but when they do fire, they fire with very precise phase locking. That means they're firing action potentials at a specific phase of the sound wave. And I'm just going to use a pointer. I think it'll work better. And so I've set this up so it takes two of these guys to set off one of these NM cells. So you can see when two go off, this guy fires, sends an action potential down there. And now when you get action potentials coming from the right and the left onto these NL cells, you can see that there's one cell here that gets its action potentials coincidentally. These guys get them with a little phase lead from one side and phase lag from the other, and these guys a bigger one. And I've color-coded the firing rate here so that red is a higher firing rate. So you can see that this guy that gets the simultaneous inputs is firing the fastest, and these guys are firing a little bit slower, and this one even slower. So you're basically going from a time code here where you have these precisely timed spikes to a rate code over here.
Demonstration of the Jeffers model.
Yeah, so this is based on the Jeffers model. The chicken, in fact, there's a lot of evidence that the chicken follows, and owls and birds follow a modified Jeffers model. At least in gerbil now, there's some evidence that you don't have delay lines and you don't need the Jeffers model. For the purposes of what I'm going to say today, it doesn't matter whether you have delay lines or not. What's very important is, and it's demonstrated in this next one, is that when the inputs from in the case of the mammal from the AVCN, when they arrive synchronously at the MSO cells in the mammal, that those cells fire fastest and that they modulate their firing rate as a function of the phase delay of the synaptic inputs. So in the case of mammals, you wouldn't have separate cells coding for each position because of these delay lines. They're all going to have the same modulation of firing rate as a function of phase delay It doesn't matter where the sound is in, but then there's some kind of population code, or it's read out some other way. But in either case, it's going to work for what I'm going to talk about today. Okay, I just showed the delay lines here because they exist in the chicken. So this is just looking at a little bit more detail, quickly in a cartoon, at these NL cells and the way they respond to these phase-locked inputs. So there they are. You can see that not all of these guys fire on every cycle. When you crank up the amplitude of the sound, then you start recruiting more and more of these guys. And so then you get spikes on every phase rather than skipping cycles. And you can see this guy's getting them. And now if the sound moves somewhere else, in the case of birds, now what's going to happen is, I think I screwed this up and have one extra one in here, but this guy's going to be getting the stuff in phase because the sounds move somewhere else. And this guy with a little bit of a phase delay for between the two sides, one, an even bigger one. Okay, so there's this grading of firing rates, or as you modulate the phase delay, to one of these cells, it's going to decrease its firing rate. And this is real data. And this is data taken from a cat, and this is from a chicken. Okay, and so this is recording from the medial superior olive, and this is from the chicken nucleus laminaris. And what they did was put earphones on these animals, gave them pure tones, and then systematically delayed the onset of these tones to one ear versus the other ear, and measured the firing rate in these cells. And you can see that they modulate their firing rate as a function of the, in this case, interval time difference, or you could put this as the phase difference between the sine waves at the frequency of the tone. Now, the other thing they did in this particular experiment in the cat medial superior olive, so there's a tonotopic organization to the auditory system, which I'm going to say more about later because it turns out to be important in some predictions that we made and then tested in humans. And that is that these cells respond best to a certain frequency of sound. This is actually laid out in the periphery and then maintains through. So they found the best frequency for this particular cell, and then they looked at how the firing rate was modulated as a function of the phase delay or interval time difference. And then they actually checked, so I guess this cell was tuned to I think this one here, 400 hertz, and then they went either lower or higher in frequency, and that you can see that the cell still responds, but now not as well. The reason this worked at all is because they cranked up the intensity pretty good, so that they got some spread in the circuit or along the basilar membrane. But again, I'm going to come back to this point. Okay, so the basic job of these NL cells is to modulate firing rate as a function of the phase offset between their arriving action potentials from the right and left ear, or from the synaptic potentials that are generated at these cells from the right and the left. So that's the basic function that these guys do. Okay, so now let's look in a little bit more detail at these guys that are taking the phase lock action potentials from the eighth nerve and then relaying them up as phase locked action potentials to these nucleus laminaris cells. Okay, so this is one of those nucleus laminaris cells. They're great cells to work with if you want to do voltage clamp or whatever, because they basically don't have a dendrite. They're round cells, so they're really easy to handle. And they have these giant synaptic inputs. I said they get on average 3. They form Kaelicil type inputs. They have several hundred release sites, excitatory release sites per synaptic input. So this is 1/8 nerve fiber, and they're tuned for speed and accuracy. So if you stimulate the 8th nerve and voltage clamp the excitatory synaptic currents generated in these cells, this is an example there. You can see they can follow at very high rates, and they're very brief. They're more than an order of magnitude shorter in duration than sort of typical EPSPs like you'd record in the hippocampus, time constants of like 0.2 milliseconds. Okay, so that's what the inputs to these guys look like. Now, if you, during intracellular recordings of these cells, give little current steps like a train of pulses, and what I'm doing is comparing here one of these NM cells to one of those cortical neurons I show at the beginning that show that spike frequency adaptation, which, by the way, is due primarily to buildup of calcium and sodium-dependent potassium currents and maybe some slow sodium inactivation. That if you give these repeated steps of current to evoke action potentials in one of these cortical cells, what happens is, because of this buildup of these currents, which slow the trajectory towards firing or pose threshold, what happens is if you look superimpose all these little steps here, you can see that the timing of the spikes gradually gets more and more delayed. So this is like the first spike, the second spike, the third spike down here, and then this is later ones and later ones. Okay, now if you do the same thing in one of these NM cells, you can see these spikes really align very nicely. Okay, so this is a form of memory that these guys don't have, at least over these short time scales here. You know, like if you give a stimulus of 100 milliseconds or so, this is going to stay a lot like that. And so why would that memory be really bad in the system I'm just showing you? Well, here's a little schematic. So here would be two sound waves. Here's a sound wave where it's arriving at both ears simultaneously, or at one ear a little bit before the other ear. And then what happens is you generate these phase-locked action potentials in the nucleus magnus cellularis on the left or on the right. They don't fire on every cycle, but when they fire, they always fire on the same phase of the sound wave. And so here, with a little bit of a phase lead, you can see these guys aren't aligned anymore. And these cells down here, they're great coincidence detectors or differentiators. As I said, they're designed to modulate their fine rate as a function of whether these things come in phase or out of phase. So in this example, you get spike here, 2 to 10 go, and nothing here. Now, if you had a little bit of adaptation, the kind I showed you in the cortical cell, and so that, let's say, when you had a short interval between these two spikes, you got enough of a buildup of this calcium-dependent K that this spike occurred a little bit later, then what would happen is you'd get something like this, where now you wouldn't get firing here because this spike is a little bit later. Yeah, this is a long enough delay. Maybe you didn't get adaptation, so you still get a spike here. And then this one here that didn't give you a spike before now does. And so now when you look at the firing rate in NL, you can't tell whether you had a phase lead or a phase lag. So that kind of a process or mechanism could potentially totally screw up the ability to modulate fine rate as a function of phase delay in the nucleus laminaris. Okay, so now let's start looking at some more recent data from these NM cells. So this just shows, I showed you the response properties of a cortical neuron to a whole sequence of steps of current of different means and different standard deviations. And so this is the same kind of plot here on one of these NM cells, where firing rate versus mean current. I don't even show the one where it's just a step of current with no standard deviation, because these cells don't fire at all to that. They'll fire one spike or two spikes at the onset, and then they don't fire at all. Okay, so that's, and then if you put in a little bit of fluctuation in the input, then they start to fire a little bit. And if you put in more fluctuation, they fire more, and more fluctuation, they fire more. It does look like there's a sweet spot in the mean current where they're actually doing a better job of modulating the rate as a function of the standard deviation of the inputs. But the main thing that's making this thing go is increasing the size of the fluctuation. And it turns out there's probably some frequency dependence to those fluctuations, too, of what's the best one in a particular cell. But that's another story. Okay, so now if we give one of these steps of current that's got these noisy fluctuations in it, and in this case, it's actually passed through, I think, a 0.2 millisecond exponential filter.
Is this sort of some resonance of cells?
It's another story. So it turns out that these guys actually do have some resonance, and they're bandpass, and it's tonotopically organized, so that...
threshold or supra-threshold resonance?
Hmm?
Are you talking about sub-threshold or supra-threshold?
Super-threshold. Super-threshold resonance. So this is, yeah. So if you, for example, make a plot of gain versus frequency for firing in these cells, and actually we just published this in J Neurophys this past year, it's organized across the tonotopic somewhat. It's not a monotonic organization. It increases from the frequency increases from the low frequency and up to about the mid frequencies, and then kind of levels off in terms of where the peak is. But the absolute amplitude of the gain gets higher and higher as you go to higher frequency. It's kind of another story.
Right. No, is it? I mean, you're just saying it's...
Well, this implies that. So if you did this in the cells of different frequencies, you might expect this peak to occur at different points. And we've got some data on that, but not enough that I really can say anything firm about it. Okay, so now I want to get into the adaptation that we observed a few years ago in these cells. So if you actually play a step of current to these cells that has these fluctuations in it, and you do it, so first of all, you have to have the fluctuations to get these cells to fire repetitively. And if you do this now for a long period of time, in this case 20 seconds, what you can see is there's actually a gradual increase over about the first 5 to 10 seconds in the firing rate. So this is kind of the reverse of what you see in cortical neurons during a constant input. Some people call this warm-up firing. So there's this increase in firing rate that occurs slowly over time. And so the next few slides are just a little bit about what the mechanism of this is. So one of the clues about the mechanism of this is that in order to get this warm-up firing or this increase in rate what I've shown here is the injected current, the voltage response, and then the count of the spikes per second, in this case over 5 seconds. And this first one is like the first example where there's a little bit of a mean and these fluctuations. Now, if you don't have any, if the mean varies around zero, if the mean is zero and the fluctuations occur around zero, the level of depolarization, the average interspike depolarization of these cells is less. And if you don't get much depolarization in between the spikes, you don't get this adaptation. In fact, you get a little bit of decrease in firing rate. And the other point is that this is spike independent. So basically, we took advantage of the fact that these cells don't fire during DC steps of current. So what we did was we gave a step of current that had a positive mean and fluctuations, got the cell firing, then turned off the fluctuations and just left the current depolarized, the cell stops firing, and then went and turned the fluctuations back on, and you can see the rate had increased. So this is depolarization dependent and spike independent. Okay, so based on that, we knew these cells are pretty simple, and they basically are dominated by a low threshold activated potassium current that turns out to be of the KV1 type potassium channel family. And this just shows what it looks like in voltage clamp. This is a current. Sorry, this is a little bleached out with this projector, but during a short step, that's 1 millisecond there, voltage clamp step, you can see it activates very, very rapidly. During longer steps, these are, I think, 10 or 5 second steps, you can see it activates, and then during these depolarizations shows this very slow inactivation. This inactivation goes on for many, many seconds. In fact, I don't even know what its time course is, but it keeps going on for at least 20 seconds. Okay, so this is something that would be more, we thought this might be the underlying mechanism, and one of the reasons is here's the response of one of these cells to a step of current. You see it fires one spike and then shuts down. If you put on alpha dendrotoxin, which is a very selective blocker of some of the subunits of this type of K channel, you can see now these cells can fire repetitively. So they actually fire even to a DC current, and if you give fluctuations, they'll fire faster also. And so since these cells are dominated by these currents and they show this slow inactivation, so there's less and less of it over time, we thought, maybe this was why they're showing this warm-up firing. And the next slide just sort of, I think, pins this down. It's a little bit of a complicated experiment, but what we did was what we call a hybrid clamp, where we voltage clamp the membrane potential at minus 60, and then turn off the voltage clamp and quickly inject this noisy current step, and then turn the voltage clamp back on at some preset voltage. In this case, it was probably about, minus 30 millivolts. And then go back and turn off the voltage clamp, turn on the current clamp, and put in our fluctuating current. We can then look at the firing rate at the beginning and the end of one of these steps, and so you get, and you can control what the voltage was in between each of these current stimuli. And so you see this adaptation or this warm-up firing. And then we do the same thing in the presence of dendrotoxin. And you can see that during this voltage step, this K current here, which inactivates, is gone, right? And now the firing rate, which was actually higher here, we actually turned the current way down during the stimulus. So, this cell's going to fire much faster. And it's still firing really fast, but now you don't see this adaptation. And we have some where we've got matched firing rates at the beginning and the end. And so you wipe out this increase in firing rate by blocking this K current, is the point of this slide. Yeah.
To my mind, these cells are acting like they're an axon.
Yeah.
Because that's how axons.
They are. That's a great way, first pass way to look at them. But it's not really like that. So there's a whole nother story in these guys now. KV1 is like a dominant K channel in axons at the nodes of RONVA. It's really, really important. These guys have a ton of it at their soma and on their axons. The other interesting thing about these cells, though, is, there's some more complicated stuff going on, and there's some nice papers on it from Kanishi and from a Japanese group, from Amori's group, but basically, they don't have any sodium channels on their soma. And so their spikes are all generated actually at the first node of RONVA. They don't really even have much of an initial segment. And then there's this organization where the nodes are systematically further and further away the higher the frequency of the cell, the cell that's tuned to higher frequencies. And then there's a whole really complicated model about why it would be good to have that to get these cells, to help give them their frequency tuning, some of the resonance that I think you asked about. Yeah, but it's a complicated, so they're not, it's actually important that they have these separate compartments and that are operating differently. Yeah. Let me just back up a second and say something. So I spent sort of the beginning saying, listen, the real job of these NM cells is to give well-timed spikes to the NL. And I've been sitting here telling you all this stuff about how the rate goes up during this, so what do we care about rate? And indeed, there's a whole bunch of evidence that these cells do everything they can to filter out changes in rate. So when you crank up the intensity of a sound, the rate of these NM cells goes up. They stay phase-like, but they start firing to more and more cycles during a tone. But it turns out that the effect of that on the modulation of firing rate in the NL versus phase delay is really, really minimal. And there's, this is like three separate talks, but there's a whole bunch of mechanisms that go in to making these cells, the NL cells ignore changes in rate in the NM. And so these are just some key references for each of these different mechanisms. It's kind of interesting because each of these guys are sensing something different to basically feed back and filter out rate changes. The synaptic inhibition is sensing circuit activity, membrane, postsynaptic membrane properties are sensing the activity in the cell itself, and the fast synaptic dynamics are sensing activity at individual synapses. Yeah.
Are you saying that if you increase the intensity of the sound, don't increase the firing rate of the cell?
You increase the firing rate of the NM cells, but if you look then at, this experiment's been done, let me just tell you. So let's say you go in and you record from the nucleus laminaris or the medial superior olive. Actually, it's been best done in owls in the nucleus laminaris, where they move sound around. And so they measure the modulation of firing rate. They give pure tone, so do this for a pure tone, and you measure firing rate versus interval time difference, like those curves I showed you before, and they go down like that. And now you do exactly the same thing again, but crank up the intensity. So same tone, same frequency, but just higher intensity. you know, when you first start doing it, you know, it builds up, but once you get up to about 40 dB or something, those curves pretty much overlap. So that modulation firing rate versus phase delay stays pretty constant even over a whole range of changes of intensity. Now, so why do we even care about intensity? Well, there are a whole other circuits that are coding for intensity that are doing other things, like that circuit I told you about that for example, deals with the fall off in intensity between the two ears, and then there's also monaural things. But in this particular circuit, there's a lot of mechanisms that go to making the cells that they project to ignore changes in firing rate in these guys.
40
dB is like, nah, not too loud. But 20 dB would be like threshold, and then like 70 dB would be pretty loud, and 90 dB would be really loud. Yeah. Okay. So what about timing, and what about this K current? Well, okay, so here's an extreme example. Now, if you give a periodic stimulus to one of these NM cells, in this for this purposes, let's just imagine it's a sine wave. This was actually a more complicated periodic stimulus, and I'll show you exactly what it looked like later on in another example. But so you're giving a periodic stimulus like you'd see during a tone, a pure tone, to one of these NM cells, and then you know you can look at the spike output and you can quantify how good the phase locking is with a phase histogram. So you just take one cycle and you plot all the spikes and say, or you take all the cycles and you say, okay, when did each spike occur during each of these cycles? And so you make a phase histogram. So here's the number of spikes during this particular experiment, during this cycle. I guess this particular one was done at 1,000 hertz. And you can see that there's this bit, and we've just fit this to a sine wave, you can see there's this very nice phase locking. Okay, and you can quantify this. The auditory people then do just fit vectors to this, do a circular statistic and plot this as vector strength, where if all these spikes occurred during any one time bin, that would be a vector strength of 1, and if this thing was just flat across there, that would be a vector strength of 0. Okay, or you can just measure the jitter as the standard deviation of like a Gaussian fit to this. Now, if you put on this alpha dendrotoxin, you can see you pretty much wipe out. I mean, I fit something to this, but it's not very good phase locking, and the spikes are jittered all over. So this KV1 channel is very important to these cells in terms of being able to maintain this very precise phase locking that these cells occur. Okay, so now what happens during
phase locking at all with alpha dendrotoxin? Would you say whether any significant phase locking or not?
That was not significant phase locking. Yeah, it's basically pretty much wipes it out. Yeah, so that's an extreme case where you've gotten rid of all those channels. Now, what happens during this adaptation or during a long stimulus where presumably these KV1 channels are slowly inactivating? Right.
Yeah, so my interest was because it seemed if there was any remaining phase locking, the preferred phase was shifted. My question would have been, why would the phase shift?
In that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So well. Yeah, I don't think it was significant. Yeah.
But if you had some.
But there are reasons. I mean, if you just did a little bit of lock, you might get a phase shift. And I'd have to sort of think about sort of in detail why that really happened. But it wouldn't surprise me if it happened. Yeah. Because it also controls sort of the rise through the spike, so the timing of the spike relative to the rise of the input is going to change. Okay, this K current turns on as the membrane potential is approaching threshold, so you could see where it could cause a phase shift. Okay, so here's our long noisy stimulus again. Here's that increase in firing rate. And now, if we did this frozen noise where we do this over and over and over again, and then we can make a raster here of all the spikes and look at the spikes, say, at the beginning and the spikes at the end, and then measure the jitter. In this case, it's not a periodic stimulus, so I can't do vector strength. You can see that, indeed, the jitter goes up in most of the cells. Okay, so the spike timing starts to degrade in these cells when you give a long stimulus. So this is a new form of adaptation that is adaptation of spike time precision.
So on the original plot, you had a scale that went from like 0 to 1,000 microseconds, right? The width of
That was, yeah, because it was 1,000 hertz tone in that case.
I mean, I'm just looking at here, this is like, this scale is like 50 microseconds. Is this jitter physiologically significant?
Yeah, so I'm going to show you an example more relevant in a second here. So, that's right. So okay, what about during more physiologic stimuli? So, that's what we do here. Okay, so now we went back and said, well, we want to see whether you get this change in spike time precision during more realistic inputs, because maybe it wouldn't happen, right? And so the way we do these experiments is we're going to do a patch clamp recording from one of these cells in the slice, but what we can do is specify an input. In this case, we, in a computer, say, okay, we've got 3/8 nerve fibers. We can make a tone that has a specific frequency. In these experiments, it's going to be 1,000 hertz. We can then say, okay, each of these three inputs are going to fire phase-locked action potentials, right, in response to this tone, depending on the mean rate that would represent the intensity of the tone. And these were designed, these were average firing rates of about 200 hertz, which is a bit about what people record in vivo for mid-sound intensities from these cells. And then based on the known properties of the synaptic inputs, every time there's one of these spikes, we can turn it into a little synaptic conductance. And so we specify the time course of synaptic conductance. So we sum all these together, and we get some waveform of synaptic conductances, which is what these cells would see in vivo, presumably. There's no inhibition in this particular experiment, but it's what they would see from their excitatory inputs during a pure tone of 1,000 hertz.
With some, you made some assumption here as to the number of active inputs. I'm just looking at, when you made G of T, you made the conductance.
Yeah.
I mean, you have so much, you started with a, with essentially.
We start with a tone, or with a sine wave.
But the nerve inputs are all the same height, and then you're adding them together, right? So you're, how many did you add together when you made G of T?
So we added three together in this case, and the way we decided that is because at the anatomy on these cells says on average they get 2.7 each. So some of them get 2 and some of them get 3. So it's a really simple circuit, so it's really easy to do. So we gave them 3 in this particular experiment. Okay? That's how we decided, because people have done the anatomy. Yeah. So it was based on that, and we used a method called dynamic clamp where we injected these as conductances. These are probably perfect cells to do excitatory conductances and dynamic clamp, because the inputs really come in on the soma, and so the soma really sees that conductance. You know, it may not make that much sense to do dynamic clamp on a pyramidal cell where you've got an electrode on the soma. But for this, it's a great place to do that. And so that's what we did. And so now what we can do is we can give these stimuli, and we can give them for long periods of time, and we can look at the jitter of the spikes in relation to this periodic stimulus and the vector strength, and also what the firing rate was. And so we did that. And the other thing, I left this out. I mean, so people have made a whole bunch of measurements in vivo. They know, for example, for 1,000 hertz tones, what the jitter of these guys is. And so I didn't show that here, but these guys actually have the natural jitter statistics. These synaptic, when you turn these into synaptic inputs, they show fast synaptic dynamics. They show a lot of depression, and we actually had that in there too. So all that stuff was built in there. In fact, I think I summarized for people that are interested. In this particular experiment, there's all the parameters. So it was 1,000 hertz, 3 inputs. Average firing rate was 250 hertz of each of the 8th nerve inputs. There was jitter. There was depression. And there's the parameters that describe the time course of the synaptic, the EPSGs. So it was an alpha function with a time constant of 0.25 millisecond. Okay, One other little caveat, these cells, I mentioned that these cells don't have sodium channels, so you don't see very big spikes, and when you do these kinds of stimuli, it's really hard to tell what's a spike and what's just your stimulus. And so it's really hard. So, you know, if you recorded from blebs, you could tell what the spikes were, but that's not easy to do routinely. So the way we did these experiments is we'd make one of these waveforms, right, and we'd do our experiment, and then we'd repeat the entire waveform in the presence of TTX. So there's what we got, and like, you know, is that a spike there? And then we do it in TTX, and then we there's the stimulus, and then you subtract, and you can tell where the spikes were. And in fact, somebody else, Nace Golding, has at least in the gerbil, has actually validated by doing bleb recordings from axons that each of these little blips, in fact, are action potentials. So that's how we did this. And so here's the results. Here's the spikes per second during a 10-second stimulus. And then here's the period histograms at the beginning in red, and at the end in black shows the increase in firing rate. There's up to about a 10 microsecond increase in jitter and a decrease in vector strength. 10 microseconds doesn't sound like a lot, but it turns out that actually is important in this system, and I hope in the next few slides to convince you that it's important, because when we saw this, we said, okay, fine. So there is a little bit of increase in jitter during what our best guess of a natural stimulus would be. Now, as an aside, we've also done the same experiment where we also added in inhibition on top of our excitation. These cells actually have depolarizing inhibition, and this increases it even more. What inhibition basically does is increases the membrane time constant of these cells more by increasing the conductance, pushes the membrane potential even more depolarized because its reversal potential is about minus 30 millivolts, even in adult. And so it turns on more of this KV1 type channel. But I won't show you that. So this just shows, you know, one of the things that happens. So if you look at here, you know, at the beginning of one of these long stimuli in the end, and we designed one where we had sort of an identical segment at the beginning and the end, and then you overlay the response in the unadapted, which is red, and the black, which is adapted, you can see that there's this increase basically in the membrane time constant. There's probably also some effects on spike threshold too, on spike threshold accommodation, but we haven't really got good enough voltage measurements to trust to know whether that was. I mean, it doesn't look like there's any change there, but I think there are. Okay, so now I want to concentrate on these guys, because the question is, do these little changes in spike timing precision actually matter to the modulation of firing rate versus phase delay in the nucleus laminaris? So the way we're going to do this experiment is we're going to stimulate NL cells by basically simulating a set of inputs that come from the right NM and a set of inputs that come from the left NM, and we're going to sum them together with various phase delays and inject them into these NL cells and say, how does firing rate modulate as a function of phase offset? So the way we did that so we can go in and specify how many cells there are, how many NM cells there are, and so on. And there it's a little bit more guesswork. So the estimates of how many NM cells there are that project to an NL cell from each side are somewhere between about 40 and 150. And in the experiments I'm showing you, I think we had 70 per side. So we picked some number in the middle. So the way we did this is we took our real data when we did those natural stimuli to NM, and we took the actual spike outputs, and so we did many of these, we took a bunch of different cells, and then we're going to take the real spike times that we got out of NM at the beginning, and so we just randomly sampled different segments of this and say, okay, that's going to be the spike times for cell number one in NM and another sample cell number two and so forth. And we're going to do the same thing then for another set of inputs. Then we pass these guys, we basically turn them into synaptic currents in this case. These guys have dendrites, so we didn't do this in dynamic clamp. We just injected these as currents. And we're gonna then do the same thing for a set of NM cells from the other side, sample another bunch of segments, and generate a waveform which would be what's arriving from, say, the contralateral NM. Now, I don't know if I really have time to get into this, but I put this in because this is a theory group and it's the only theory I actually have in here, but it turns out picking the right time course of the synapses in this was very important, okay? And we knew that this was going to be like this because we had actually, Alex Reyes, when he was a postdoc in my lab a bunch of years ago, did this. And when he used, for example, 1,000 hertz tones, right, he could never get modulation of firing rate versus phase delay. We could do it for 400 and 600 hertz, but it really degraded, okay? And then more recently, okay, I will go into this just briefly, but basically, what?
Just a question of the previous slide. How did you drive this NM cells?
The NM cells were just like what I had showed you before, where we had generated 3/8 nerve impulses. So we took the results of those experiments and took the output of NM, and now we have those records, and we can go and then sample those output spike times and use those to make the spike times that we're going to use to now drive NL. And as you'll see in a second, we either take the adapted or the unadapted spike times, right? So we're taking the real statistics that came out when we drove them with the NM cells with natural statistics from the eighth nerve. Yeah?
I think I didn't get the jitter measurement. So the jitter is defined across frozen noise trend. The jitter is defined as cross-frozen noise trend.
So the jitter in these was we take, we do a Gaussian set to the period histogram and then take the standard deviation of that.
But you measure the spikes across.
Well, in this experiment I'm showing you, we just check the real spike times. So we're not even measuring jitter. We're just saying, when did the spike occur? Let's use that as the timing for our spike. That, you know, when did it occur relative to the sine wave that we had originally put into the NM cell?
In the previous result, you get the spikes with two tribes, one with TTX and one without?
No, we get the spikes without TTX, and we can't tell whether there are spikes there. So we do exactly the same thing again with TTX, and then we say, oh, there was a spike. Now we know when the spike occurred. Okay, and we can go back and say, when did that spike occur relative to the sine wave that we put in that drove the eighth nerve inputs that we had simulated? Maybe I'll go back. I mean, later on, you and I can meet. We can go over that slide in detail.
To measure the spikes with at least two tribes.
We measure the spike, yeah, I guess you could say that. We do a subtraction of one trial from the other. Yeah, it's exactly the same thing both times. And so we just subtract one record from the other because one has spikes and one doesn't. But we can't really see the spikes when we haven't subtracted them.
I think Robert's question is, what is the source of the additional variability? Because late, you have more variability.
Oh, no, yeah, but that's nothing to do with the TTX.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're giving some stimulus that lasts 5 seconds, okay? And the variability builds up during that stimulus, okay? But we're trying to tell, we can't even measure that variability because we can't tell where the spikes are. So now we give exactly that same 5 second stimulus, exactly the same thing again, where we blocked all the spikes. And now we can take the voltage response without spikes and subtract it from the voltage response that had the spikes but that we really can't see very well, and we can see them better. I mean, an old method is just to look at the dVdt, the first derivative of the voltage response, but that doesn't work well in these guys because the membrane time constant is so fast that it's really hard to see the inflection of the first spike. So dVdt is not very reliable.
Is the current, the voltage that you measure with TTX also more variable back there?
We never looked at that. All we did was just look at the spikes and the spike times. So what we can say is that the voltage response is smeared out. It's a little bit slower. So I showed, I mean, I showed you a sub-threshold example of that.
Could be all, I mean, that wouldn't explain an increase in variability, because it would be the same smeared out.
Right, that could explain it. Well, yes, and so I think that is part of it, because those K currents are controlling that. Basically, one thing they do is control the sub-threshold voltage response, and the time constant becomes longer, and so the thing gets more smeared out. Ah, what you're saying, if we could measure like the peak of an EPSP that was sub-threshold, would that jitter around? I'm not so sure it would jit around, but what you do is you broaden the receptive field so that some that never gave you spikes before, that's why you get an increase in rate, will now give you spikes. And those ones that are now giving you spikes that didn't before carry less temporal information, like they're slower, smaller depolarizations, or they're due to smaller and slower current inputs. And so they're not necessarily jittering from trial to trial. I don't know if they actually jitter more from trial to trial. I guess we can check that. Yeah, we haven't done that. Huh? Yeah, and actually I may have a plot of that. I have this one thing where she just measured everything. This is all from one of my graduate students. And you were on the thesis committee, and you might have asked her to measure that, and we might have that data, but I just don't remember it off the top of my head.
Ones that survive. So basically you're getting a lowering of the threshold, and so you get extra spikes being added in that are more, they're less temporal size, just as well.
Yeah. So anyway, back to this thing about the EPSPs, because this is like the only theory I have in here, So I mentioned that these NL cells, what they need is they need variable inputs, okay? And so the idea is that as you go from very small phase delays to large phase delays, the inputs need to go from a lot of variability to not much variability, okay? So we just made a simple model where actually in this case we just took two comb functions. And we just summed them together with different phase delays and said what's, you don't get, I guess we took those comb functions and passed them through then an alpha function, and we used alpha functions with different time constants. So we're passing them through a little synaptic conductance. Or in this case, I guess it was a synaptic current. And so you don't get a normal distribution. So we took the mean absolute distribution, and this just shows an example of what the mean absolute distribution looked like of the output of these two comb functions passed through. I forget what the alpha function was like in this case, but of 0 degrees phase delay or 180 degrees phase delay. And the idea was, if you then take the subtraction of this from that, what alpha function, what time course EPSC gives you the biggest change in the mean absolute deviation when you go from 0 to 180 degrees phase delay? So there's different alpha functions that we put into this model, and you can see this guy here gave, this is the subtraction of the 0 and 180 degrees mean absolute deviation. This guy gives the greatest one, and this is a plot of mean absolute deviation versus phase delay. And then for each of these other points, these are the other ones. So you can see you got the inputs doing the biggest modulation of its variability as a function of phase delay for this particular, in this case, for a tau of 0.19 milliseconds. So then we can do this for all different sound frequencies, and we get a theory curve. And this theory predicts what the optimal unitary EPSC half width would be for a given sound frequency. And that's the curve there. And so I'll just skip over the next slide, which is like how we, so we actually then experimentally measure this. Whoops. So we kept track of where we are along the tonotopic map of these NL cells, and we stimulated their NM inputs and measured the time course of the EPSCs. And so we broke it up into three regions, here, here, and here plots the mean and the standard deviation of the time constants for the ones in this region, and this region. So there was pretty good agreement of the time course of the EPSPs versus their position on the tonotopic map. And so now we were able to go back to this and say, okay, when we are using a 1,000 hertz tone, we need to use an EPSC that has this duration. So when Alex had done this before, he was a little bit slower. He was up there and it didn't work. So now we knew the right one to use and it actually worked. So here's the results. So this is what I was showing you. So we're going to do all this together, sum these guys together at 0 degrees phase delay, 90 degrees phase delay, 180 degrees phase delay, and measure the spike output for each of these guys and in NL. And then we can do the whole same thing again for the spike times we got from the adapted output from our NM cells. Okay? And so basically, here's the result. So here's the normalized firing rate for a whole bunch of cells versus phase delay from the control versus the adapted. And there was a significant decrease in the dynamic range and in the slope here. Okay, this is probably an underestimate. And actually, you alluded to why it might be an underestimate earlier, because we measured these spike outputs from NM at the soma. In fact, these KV1 channels are very important all the way down the axon, and you'll probably get further degradation and further jitter and more effects of its inactivation if we'd actually measured the spike outputs at where they come into the NL, rather than at the soma. And the other thing is, in this particular experiment, we had left inhibition out of our stimulus to NM. And we know, because we've done that subsequently, that when we add inhibition to our inputs to NM, that we even get more, that the effect of inactivation of KV1 is even greater. So anyway, this is probably a minimal estimate of what's going to happen for that. Now, the question was, what is this due to that increase in rate, or is it due to the change in the spike timing jitter? Because both of those changed. And this next experiment just does that. So now what we can do is we can do the same kind of experiment, but we can basically just take the increase in rate that we got coming out of NM and put that into NL, or just put in the increase in jitter and keep the rate constant, or put in both. Okay? And so here's control. Here's when we change the rate, and you can see there's very little effect. Here's when we just change the jitter by the amount we had measured in those earlier experiments. Here's both together. So this wasn't significant. So most of this comes from, in fact, the change in spike time precision. And in fact, this is almost trivial. If you look at the power spectrum of the inputs that we put in to NL, basically, this falls right out of this. So it turns out, so here's a plot of the power, or the so if you do one of these experiments and you say, okay, what's the power spectrum for all these different phase delays? So there's a whole bunch of power at DC, but these cells don't respond to DC. It doesn't change over phase delay, so the cells filter this out. And at the sound frequency you stimulate, that's where you get your biggest change in input power as a function of phase delay. At the first, the second harmonic, you get something that looks a weird shape, and then you get other weird shapes there, but this is much smaller. So the cells, to modulate their firing rate as a function of phase delay, are mostly looking at the power of the inputs at the fundamental frequency of the stimulus. Okay, so what we've done here is just plotted what the power spectrum at 1,000 hertz was, and how it changed with phase delay. And you can see that actually it goes up a little bit when you increase the rate, which isn't surprising because you're actually increasing the rate of your input. So you're going to get some more power. And then basically all of it's accounted for by the change in timing. Yeah.
How much availability of KV1 is left? I mean, if you use
a lot.
It looks like it's only adapted a little bit compared to what Binder does.
Well, this I know. So if you look at inactivation, there's probably it's only partially inactivated, and it may not even completely inactivate. So. So if we put on dendrotoxin during one of those long steps, there's still a difference between the end. Yeah.
It's like it'd be huge. but if you just keep doing longer and longer
studies. We haven't done them. I mean, for most of the experiments to get enough data and have stability, I think we did most of these were 10 seconds, I think. Yeah, but it's really slow in activation. It doesn't fully inactivate in 10 seconds. Yeah, so it's not even close to what would happen with dendrotoxin. Yeah. Okay, so.
How fast is it recovery?
Huh? We actually published in the pit. So some of this is already published, and there was a plot in there, but it's not. My recollection is on the order of half a second. So it's not real fast, but it's not as slow as the inactivation occurs. But we have a plot of that in this paper that was like 2 years ago. Yeah. If you give me a minute, I want to show you an experiment we did in humans, because basically we made some predictions now based on this, because it's like this was all well and good, and we said, so we went to a guy that does human psychophysics on auditory stuff, figuring we wanted a reference, like has any, so basically what we've got here is location independent, but what would be frequency specific adaptation. And so we figured maybe somebody's done this. And he said, no, nobody's done this. So we said, okay, let's do it. So we did it. And so the way we did it is we took people and we put earphones on them and we gave them pure tones. They were 500 millisecond tones. And so we basically had an adapter that went on for 7 seconds where the tones came on, but we systematically phase delayed randomly the onset from one ear to the other, so the person's basically hearing a sound going boop, 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 moving around different spots. And they're told that then they're going to hear a little gap, and then what happens is they hear a reference sound that comes on right in the middle, and then another one comes on a few milliseconds later that's off either to the right or the left, and it's a forced choice deal. So they have to tell you it went to the right or the left. And if they get it right, we make it harder. And if they get it wrong, we make it easier. And so we gradually hone in on when they get 70% right. So we find the minimal audible angle or the threshold for doing this task. And so we could do this thing either with an adapter or without an adapter. That was just the first step. And so here's the results of that. So this is 4 subjects, and here's the mean value with no adapter versus adapter. So it did look like there was some adaptation. But this wasn't totally satisfying because, I mean, just somebody sitting there listening to either nothing for 7 seconds or something for 7 seconds, you could argue, oh, it's all attention and so on and so forth. So we also took advantage of this thing I alluded to earlier of the tonotopic organization. So in the basal membrane, for low intensity sounds, there's, you only stimulate very restricted regions of the basilar membrane. But when you start, and this is maintained throughout these the NM and the NL by the circuitry. But when you then start cranking up the intensity of the sound wave, you start stimulating wider and wider areas of the basilar membrane. And so if you record, for example, from an NM cell, the typical tuning curve for versus frequency in terms of what they'll respond to. So here's sound intensity versus sound frequency, and this would be this cell's characteristic frequency. But you can see that this cell also responds to lower frequencies, and it's pretty sharp cutoff for higher frequencies. Okay, so what we did was that same experiment where we had our test was always 1,000 hertz, where it was in the middle and then it moved to one side or the other. And then we had an adapter that was either 1,000 hertz or 600 and, I forget, six, it'll be on this plot, 600 and something hertz. Had to be careful that you don't have have harmonics in there of the higher frequencies, or 200 hertz. That was far enough away that we were okay. So the prediction would be that it would approach no adapter the further we got away in frequency with our adapter, and that's basically what we found. So there was the response with no adapter there, and there's the response to when the adapter was 200 hertz, the adapter was 665 hertz, or the adapter was 1,000 hertz. In all of these cases, the test was at 1,000 hertz. So that's where I'm going to end. And I guess I made it with time to spare. even with a lot of questions, although I know I didn't answer them all. So I'll take more now. This is almost all the thesis work of Marina Kuznetsova, who's still hanging out in my lab for a little while. But she also had a lot of help from Matt Higgs, who's like senior postdoc, actually he's a research assistant professor now, and Sean Slee, who was a postdoc in my lab, who actually originally observed that adaptation when he was doing some other experiments. So these three guys. Okay, so any more questions? Yes.
So I'm trying to run through a thought experiment, and I don't know how far I can go. So the question is about if the KV channel mediated so-called adaptation that you call, if that's going to be playing an interesting role in improving detection of ITD. And how would it make a difference that different groups of neurons have different levels of expression of KV channel? Because that will lead to different levels of adaptation, perhaps different time course and phase shifts. How will that work out? That's part one. And part two, does the KV channel expression remain constant as a function of time? Because several potassium channel expression changes with learning and so on. Won't that mess up the delay lines or something like
that? Yeah. So there was actually a third question in there that there's a partial answer to. So the second question first. We don't know how the level of expression, so the level of expression changes during development, and it goes up during development in the embryo. So that's been measured. But in the adult and how that changes over time, or how it might change with like sound experience and stuff, that we don't know. But you might guess that it would, because there's two really important K channels in these cells and related ones. There's other cells in the auditory system that are really good at coding for time. And mostly this has been done in mammals in something called the medial nucleus of the trapezoid body, but they have really similar properties to these NM cells. They happen to be inhibitory cells and they're doing something else. And there, Len Cashmerk has a whole story where, so the other important K channel is KV3s. 3.1, they're more important for repolarizing spikes. But he has a whole story how sound experience changes phosphorylation levels of those channels and changes their levels of expression and then maybe regulates the way those cells respond to tones and things like that. So there is data on that for another K channel. Okay, so your first question was regulating just, so then that's also known. Partially. So I mentioned that these nuclei, like the NM nucleus and the NL nucleus, which also, by the way, is loaded with KV1 channels, are tonotopically organized. And it turns out there's a non-monotonic gradient of KV1 channels, which has been measured pretty carefully by the Omori group and somewhat by us in these cells. The low-frequency cells have the least amount of the KV1s. The mid-frequency ones have the highest, and then it tails off a little bit again as you get to higher frequency. And we have some ideas about why that would be, but it's sort of another story. Why you have that? Well, so part of that gradient gives this resonance, that the change in resonance across the tonotopic map that David was asking about before. And so we've got some data published on that, so you can look at that. And that is due in part to this gradient of the KV1 channels. And then the other thing is that also probably contributes to this gradient of the time course of the EPSCs. Very important for that. Actually, those measurements we made were with the KV1 channels blocked. And I didn't tell you that. That probably comes from the gradient of dendritic lengths. So the slow, and they're also about fourfold bigger EPSCs come from the ones that have the tiny little dendrites. So the dendrite gradient goes from like 50 microns at the high frequency end to like 200 microns at the low frequency end. So it's a huge gradient, and that's passive filtering, and maybe contribution from KV1 channels, which are on the dendrites, at least in mammals, which Anais Golding showed. probably helps to control that time course. So that, so yeah, that's all important. And then you want to see, did I answer your third question?
I didn't ask the third.
Well, there actually was a third question in the second question, but I can't remember what it was. It was a point that I thought was worth commenting on, but I just...
Well, it's with learning, you may have changes in K1 and through that.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. There seems to be that with KD3s in this system, so in mammals, in mice. Yeah. I remember what it was. Yeah. So you talked about the delay lines or something like that and regulating that. So, well, yeah. So, that, like, yeah, big question. Like, in an animal that has delay lines, it's like, how does it work when the head grows, right? Because the delay lines would have to change, right? And so there's a recent paper from Rubel's group in Jane Neuroscience one thing you can do is just make the things longer. But it turns out that the way you regulate the time course, so they've got sort of a qualitative, they haven't done it very quantitatively yet. But what they did is they showed anatomically there's delay lines from one side, and from the other side it's actually close to equal path lines. So it's like a modified Jeffries model where the inputs from one side all arrive at all the cells at the same time, and you get your delay from the inputs to NL from the other side. But when they made Kerschel measurements of those path lengths, it didn't really work out that well. But then they went back and they realized, there's actually the inputs from NM to NL, there's a myelinated segment, and then there's an unmyelinated segment. And so that the actual time, conduction velocity is going to vary as it goes along there when it gets to that unmyelinated segment. And at least they have some qualitative data that the length of the unmyelinated segment is, varies enough to compensate for what's wrong about the overall length. But presumably, in development, you don't just have to change the overall length, you could change the amount that's myelinated, and so then you could control the conduction velocity that way. So there's a whole bunch of available mechanisms to adjust the conduction time as you need to, for example, as the head grows. Yeah.
The experiment was made on chicks and birds.
Yeah.
And as you said, it brings to talk the mechanism. Most people think that the mechanism in birds, the mechanism in mammals, the gerbils are different. There are two different mechanisms.
Yeah.
Then at the end, you show some results of human psychophysics.
Okay, so fine. So I said at the beginning, it doesn't matter for the purposes of our talk, and now I'm going to tell you why. So the gerbils, the big deal in gerbils is maybe they don't have delay lines. But what they do have is very, very prominent, and I showed you the cat data, and the same data from gerbils, modulation of fine rate is a function of phase delay in the MSO. And the other thing is the inputs to the MSO, which come from the Bushy cells in the AVCM, show this phase locking. And anatomically, they look the same, and they're loaded with KV1 channels. I mean, and they fire the same way. They're in so many ways the same properties. It's just the code, the way you would code for. So, like in the animal, in the bird, you've got cell A codes for this position because of this delay line. Code B codes for this position because of this delay line. So that, for example, sound over here, this cell. So when I plotted. So if you actually do the in vivo experiment, right, and you plot interval time difference here, and there's zero in the middle there, you probably couldn't see this on those plots, and then you might, and firing rate versus ITD. Like for each cell, this point is going to be slightly different. So there's going to be a cell where it's over there, so that cell's coding for position over there. There's going to be one where that peaks in the middle, and then there's another one there. Okay, in the gerbil, they all align at some same point with some same delay. Okay, so now when you look down at what?
Isn't in the gerbil, there is a best ITD, but it's outside of the physiological range.
It's outside of the physiological range, and it doesn't seem to vary. It doesn't really vary with each cell. They're all about the same, and then if you block inhibition, they all shift back to zero. And so those cells still have to modulate their firing rate as a function of phase delay, but maybe you're reading out the slope or there's some population code. I mean, it's not clear how it's only read out.
Also, this German group claimed that relative to inhibition, actually related to inhibition.
Well, it's partially related to inhibition. I mean, even when they block, okay, so what they found is, so actually, the plot in their thing was this would be zero there, and they had these curves that like were over there. And then actually, when they block inhibition, they all shift over to zero. Okay, so you still get modulation firing rate as a, so it's just the delay from there to there came from inhibition. They don't actually know that. That's their model. They haven't shown how you get that and why they're all aligned like that. But the thing is, it's still important that these cells modulate their firing rate. You don't lose this relationship when you block inhibition. You just take this whole curve and shift it to zero. As an aside, don't base all mammals on the gerbil, man, because so there's a bunch of people that work on cats, for example, that still think that the gerbil may be some special case. But even if it is like the gerbil, that doesn't change. I still think what I talked about would work in mammals, because it's more how do you read the code out that's coming out of NL or out of the MSO as some population code or looking at the slope or like in the birds where it's this very nice little place code where you have one cell for each location, right? Or a few cells for each location. Yeah.
I just have kind of another question. How do you combine the output from any of these cells? Like you had a click, you're getting many cells are going to show delay or...
So you're asking a more complicated thing. What if we use more realistic sounds that are like broadband or?
Well, I'm curious. I mean, is there even psychophysical data that you combine the output from many of these channels?
Yeah. So most psychophysics is actually done probably with clicks and things like that, or now bands. I mean, there's a huge literature. So I don't know the answer to your question in this system and what would happen, and those would be fun things to check. But I mean, the most studied form of adaptation in this system is a much faster one. It's called the precedent effect, and they do things like that. But that's the problem with echoes, right? Where, so you have a sound, and then 10 or 20 milliseconds later, it's coming from there, and 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 people have sort of controlled that, where they make these artificial echoes, and they show, that the person really only hears the first one unless they change the delay or change the amplitude of the other one. So there's a whole bunch of data on that. That's like almost two orders of magnitude faster form of adaptation. This is, that's like 10 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds, up to maybe 100 milliseconds, and this was happening over seconds. So. Yeah. So it's a whole different thing, but yeah, there's a lot of interest in the precedent effect. And people study that with these more complex realistic sounds. I mean, the people that do human psychophysics or even the animal in vivo studies, they put together much more realistic stuff. The problem we have is we've already got our hands full just trying to mimic pure tones when we try and make up waveforms to inject into a cell in a slice and make it look natural. So it would be fun to try and say, oh, okay, here's what the waveform would be during, a click, for example, and put that into the cells and start seeing what happens. And that's kind of stuff that eventually we'll probably do. Yeah.
In your NM cells, do I get it right? They initiate at the first node or at some nodes?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I misspoke you. It's not actually, no, and that's actually true. It's in the NL cells is where they did that study, but there's some data that suggests the NM cells have that same organization where the myelin comes right up to the soma, basically, and then they're generated at the first node, and there's a systematic arrangement of how far they are. So there's a paper in Nature from this guy, Amori, that sort of mapped that out, and then like a model study. I can give it to you later. It's really cool. So, and then there's this other paper from Kanishi that sort of explains why it's important.
So could you, I mean, it's not obvious that by moving...
Well, it's not a passive zone. Yeah. It just doesn't have sodium channels. I mean, it's got other... Yeah, it's not a passive zone. It's got cables.
It's not obvious that moving the insulation sites into a cable will be the thing to do if you want to have precise flight time.
Yeah, so that's their point, and then they quantify why you would want a certain distance for a certain frequency to get good phase locking to different frequencies. And that's where it gets a little bit hairy. And I can't reproduce it because it wasn't my work.
And this resonance, what is actually resonating?
So the way those experiments were done were to put it like basically, well, you can do it two ways, and we did it both ways. So you either put in, you can put in noise and make the cell fire, and then you do a correlation analysis and plot like basically the gain or how well the cell's firing rate is modulated by each frequency component of the input, right? So that's what it was. Or you can just do individual sine waves of different frequency and crank up their amplitude till you get spike threshold and plot like what frequency gives you the lowest threshold. And actually the two agree pretty well. And this system is, at least in that range, was fairly linear. But
typical resonant frequencies are how much?
Oh, so the fastest ones are, they're a lot slower than the, so they're basically, they look like this, and the peak, yeah, so I think they've reached the limit of what they can do. So basically, if this is gain, you know, in terms of spikes per nanoamp, and this is frequency here on a log plot, so this would be, I guess we did these after. So this comes up like that and comes down like this, and these are like 500 hertz. Yeah. So it would have been really nice if it worked out, you know, 500, 1,000, so forth. But basically what these cells I showed you, the power spectrum of the inputs, is they're cutting out the DC, and then they, like for 1,000 hertz, they're basically getting this there, somewhere out there. It's not tuned right there. And then for the first harmonic, it's operating down there. So they filter out the harmonics, which are not systematically changing as a function of phase delay. They're filtering out the DC component, which is huge, but doesn't change as a function of phase delay. And then can, you know, do that kind of thing over there.
Yeah. So in your model synapses, as the amplitude didn't change the frequency, whereas the real synapses are on.
In the model?
Observation. Yeah, if you're trying to go from observation of the behavior of a cell to psychophysics, I mean, there's...
So you're talking about when we simulated our inputs to our NM cell, for example. Yeah, no, actually we did. So in that scheme, I didn't show depression. We actually had depression in the real thing. Yeah, I put up a slide there that said, here's what we really had there, and right. It said depression, yes, it was turned on. So So in the case of the eighth nerve to the NM input, we used depression, we used the parameters that Larry Trussell had measured. When we went from the NM to the NL, we used our own parameters that we had measured. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other question I had was, adaptation in the cortex is modified by neuromodulators, as you know. Do you think this type of adaptation is modified by modulators?
Maybe. Except that Marina, when she first came in my lab, that's what she wanted to do. She said, I want to work on auditory cells down in the NM or the NL, and I want to do modulation. And she dumped pretty much everything we had on these cells and didn't ever see anything much of an effect. They have serotonin receptors, I know that. They have some, you know, they got a bunch of receptors. So, but I don't know what all they're doing. There's some stories about during development and so forth. But we never saw clear any kind of really thing that we could work on in terms of input output properties. So I don't know. I mean, it may be because, you know, they're patch by PET recordings. It's just a round cell with a soma, and you can wash. Maybe we were washing stuff out. You know, but and definitely, you know, Len Keshmark's shown some modulator. He doesn't actually know what the modulator is. He knows it's calcium dependent, but he knows that there's modulation of the Kv3s in these cells. So I think it's an open question, you know, how much it happens in the one. I mean, there's some, you know, maybe these guys are so low level, like they're first and second order, that they're really hardwired and they're not, you know, don't need to have all the dynamics that cortex has. You know, I see cortex as a generalist. It's like I'm able to deal with all kinds of things in different situations, and you modulate it, and now it's more of a coincidence detector, now it's more of an integrator, or changes from one to the other, like I showed in that early slide, just over the course of a few seconds, where it was a perfect integrator, and 3 seconds later, it actually is doing a little bit of coincidence detection by responding. So, whereas these guys I see as specialists, you know. But that, you know, that's just a way to think about it. Who knows what really is going to be going on in the end.